following podcast is brought to you by Robots vs. Dinosaurs.
Disclaimer, this podcast is about to spoil several movies from 6 to 20 years old. Lou, read off the list.
Today, Robots vs. Dinosaurs will be spoiling for you, the listener. Barbie, Gladiator, SpongeBob SquarePants, Fear the Walking Dead, The Blind Swordsman, Zatoichi, Game of Thrones, The Clone Wars, Rebels, Andor, The Book of Boba Fett, The Mandalorian, and every single Star Wars movie.
Hello and welcome to Robots vs. Dinosaurs, the podcast where we watch a movie
or TV show
and then try to determine which one is cooler, robots, dinosaurs, or a fallen Jedi. I'm your host, Louis G, and with me as always is my co-host for the Ahsoka series, Loth Chat. Welcome to Loth Chat.
Love it.
And that is Evan Norris once again. Welcome back, Evan.
Thank you, Lou. Great to be here. Excited to dive into this midsection of season one of Ahsoka.
Evan suggested we call this podcast Loth Chat, and I thought that was perfect. So.
It's meant to be.
Welcome to Loth Chat. We're going to be talking about Loth Cats.
Unfortunately, there are no Loth Cats in episodes 3 and 4, which bring them down a few points by default.
This is true. But there are some fallen Jedi, which is cool, and some robots, which is the most important thing. No dinosaurs. So far, I'm on dinosaur watch for this show. Not a single dinosaur. So it's going to be pretty easy if you're wondering, like, which one is cooler in Star Wars, at least. Usually it's droids. All right, so today on Loth Chat, we're going to be talking about Ahsoka Parts 3 and 4. The episodes are Time to Fly and Fallen Jedi. I'll just get this out of the way right now. Director for Episode 3, directed by Steph Green, and Episode 4, directed by Peter Ramsey. Listeners, also very, very exciting. We didn't leak it. We kept a lid on things until we were given the official word, but another, independent news source has leaked, the info on Sheev and Somehow, the new Star Wars show coming out on Disney Plus later this year. So because of that, we can officially talk about more details of it, which is really exciting. Because Evan, did you watch episode 2?
I did. I consumed it. I poured over it. Lot to talk about there.
Yeah, so we'll come back to that later, but I just wanted to get listeners excited. We do have the scoop on episode 2 if you're interested in hearing more about Sheev and Somehow. And also, if you don't mind spoilers, because we got some big spoilers for that show. It's pretty exciting stuff, and it's going to have some pretty big repercussions in the Star Wars galaxy.
Yeah. Sheev and Somehow, the show the New York Times calls The Odd Couple, but bad.
All right. Let's jump into Ahsoka Part 3. Let's get right into it. Part 3, Time to Fly, starts with the ship, Ahsoka's ship, which I looked this up, and I'm always surprised when I look up a Star Wars thing, like a ship or a creature or whatever, and it doesn't actually have a name. The ship is designated T-6-1974, which is cheeky, you know, 1974. At multiple points throughout the episode, their call sign is Fulcrum. Like, when they're talking on the radio, they're like, this is Fulcrum, Fulcrum out, whatever. But, I don't know, am I wrong? Did you find out anything? Does Ahsoka's ship have a name, like the Razor Crest, or like the Millennium Falcon?
That's a good point. Fulcrum is that code name she used during Rebels to,
yep, you know,
to operate clandestinely against the Empire. So that's definitely not the name of the ship. And you're right, they never reference it. It's a great design with that fin that goes vertically and horizontally, but you're right. Now I'm going to be frustrated because it doesn't have a name. It needs a name.
A nice little design detail about that that I really appreciated is when they're in the cockpit, you can see every like couple seconds, you see the wing spinning just like a little bit, like in the background. And I don't know, it's just nice that like you get those little visual details, and it's a very cool design, like you said. All right, well, so they're in the ship. This is how the episode starts. They're in the ship, they're going through hyperspace, and Sabine is doing some Bakken lightsaber training with Hu Yang. They have some back and forth about, she's like doing, he's doing all the different call outs and different positions, and Ahsoka suggests that they try this like Zatochi style of training. And Hu Yang says she's not ready for that. So, Evan, what are your thoughts on this training scene?
Yeah, I was so glad to see this when it first aired and upon rewatch. These training scenes are so essential to Star Wars, you know, and I know it's a very slow part of The Empire Strikes Back, but it's one of the most pivotal and important parts when Luke's being trained by Yoda. And it's something we really, sadly, I'm still salty about this, that we missed Obi-Wan training Anakin, right? We just fast forward 10 years between Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones. And these training moments are so essential to the Jedi way, so essential to establishing these relationships between master and apprentice. So I was so glad to see this. One, just cool to see Hu Yang with his like virtual training gear and how he could like measure slash marks and if it's accurate, that kind of thing. But then having some time for Ahsoka the Master and Sabine the Padawan to interact, to learn from each other, to fail, to get up and try again, that kind of thing. So I'm so glad they started the episode with this, but at the same time, I wish there was more of this. A lot of this episode is dedicated to a space chase and space battle later on, and I wouldn't have minded if the running time for this training and the space fight had been inverted and we got more time of Ahsoka and Sabine training. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I said in episode one they kind of lingered on Ahsoka solving that Resident Evil puzzle down on the
right.
Arcana ruins, and it wasn't interesting. This though, they took their I feel like they did take their time. They let the scene breathe and they let you kind of sink into it and just kind of watch. Like they're also like later they did the same thing with the battle between her and Baylan, where you just see like we'll get there, but they just kind of linger on some of these shots, and that's when it works. Like that's when you want time to chew on these things and watch these standoffs. I was more reminded of the training scene from A New Hope with when Sabine put on the blaster helmet, which I think like I kind of did some research. Ahsoka, when she talks about like we should try the Zatochi technique. There's a famous samurai fictional character, Zatoichi, the blind swordsman. And I think that this is a reference to that. And I think that's what Zatochi is when you have your Padawan put on a blaster helmet so they can't see. And then, you know, you either have like a little training droid float around and shoot blasters at them, or you fight them and pop up in different places around the room and throw your voice like a ventriloquist.
Well, I think that reference to A New Hope is perfect because Sabine utters a line that I think Luke says to Obi-Wan on the Millennium Falcon, right? She says, "I can't see. How am I supposed to fight?" And I think that's exactly what Luke says to Ben when he insists that he puts the blast shield down. So, yeah, that parallel makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. And as far as Hu Yang, I just love his visual design is amazing. Like whenever it transitions from CG to a practical, it's seamless, and you get like these little head shakes and you get these little like, you know, it just looks like the prop itself is being manipulated by somebody. But whenever he's moving and like doing, you know, complex movements and everything, it just looks so smooth. I love his design. I love his little shoulder arms.
Yeah.
And they just do everything with that training sequence so visually. Like when he pops up the results of the thing, you don't need to understand the visual layout of the red and the white slashes and the angles of them. You're like, oh yeah, those are hits and misses. You know, it just conveys that so simply and so effectively.
Yeah, Hu Yang was such an amazing addition to this show and voiced beautifully by Tennant. He's got some great lines in this episode, and he's very logical, but also lacks tact, which we talked about in the previous episode. So he's just hilarious, not by making a joke, but by speaking so matter-of-factly, because we're all trained to speak, you know, nicely to one another, but he doesn't have that, you know, he doesn't have that chip, I guess, in his chassis.
Yeah, he's like C-3PO if he wasn't a coward.
That's great, yes.
Yeah, actually, there was a moment in this episode where I got really frustrated with Sabine, because she, when they're pulling up to the planet in Danab or whatever, what's it called?
The Danab system, the planet Cetos.
And they come out of hyperspace and they're far away, and she's like, why did we, you know, pop out of hyperspace so far away? And he's like, well, it's standard Jedi protocol that blah, 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 blah. And she's like, ugh, he's doing this again. And I'm like, doing what? Answering the question that you just asked? Why you asked? And he's a robot. That's what he does. Ahsoka has a good line here when she says, anger and frustration are quick to give power, but also unbalance you. Ahsoka is a great character. I love every iteration that we've seen of her throughout all of these series. You know, obviously it's like Dave Filoni's baby. Like this is his most precious character probably, because he created her for the Clone Wars show, more or less. And so and spoilers, if you haven't seen episode 5, we get to see like all of these different phases of Ahsoka yet again. But I just love like where she ends up in this show, like the way she fills in the mentor role, the Jedi Master, well, not Jedi, but I guess Force User Master role, and just sits very comfortably in that.
Yeah, it's definitely a continuation of the Clone Wars and Rebels, but she's also a little different, a little wiser. I've been thinking a lot about this morning and last night. I was reading on the Wikipedia page for Ahsoka that Filoni, I understand, compared Ahsoka in the show, her journey from Clone Wars and Rebels to Ahsoka, the TV show, as kind of Gandalf the Grey to Gandalf the White, kind of reborn a bit. I'd never thought of that. It's a very interesting analogy. Same character, but just with a different mission, a different mindset. And I can kind of see that. Ahsoka here she's still a warrior. She's still a Ronin. And we talked a bit about that in the last episode, but she's kind of, if I had to place her in the long line of, what does Hu Yang say? The long line of non-traditional Jedi that she comes from. Great line. She's still got like Anakin's martial prowess, and her force sensitivity is amazing, a lot like Anakin, but she seems to have inherited the wisdom of Obi-Wan. Right? She's calmer. She's more balanced, much more balanced than Anakin is. Although she gets imbalanced later on in this episode, in the following episode, which causes her to fall.
Is that fair? Is Obi-Wan a non-traditional Jedi?
So he's the one that is kind of, right, Qui-Gon, absolutely.
Yes.
Anakin,
yeah.
Undoubtedly. Obi-Wan, you know, I don't know if that's fair. He's kind of the prototypical Jedi. He's loyal to a fault to the Jedi Order. You know, he won't walk away from it for the love of his life, right? Satine. And he's a good soldier. He's a good wizard. You know, he's just like, he might not have the strength or the force prowess of Anakin or Mace Windu or that kind of thing, but he's kind of like the one you look to. So he is a little cheeky. He's a little kind of sometimes goes his own way, but not really. So I would say 3 out of 4, right? We've got Qui-Gon, we've got Anakin, we've got Ahsoka, but Obi-Wan is pretty much the prototypical Jedi.
And who was Qui-Gon's master?
Is it mentioned somewhere? I mean, Yoda trains everyone, right? Because I guess he just, like, he trains all of the Padawans in that big gymnasium in the Jedi temple. I'm not sure who was... I'm sure it's on Wikipedia somewhere.
I opened up the Wikipedia page, but it's the entry for... Dooku. So, yeah, that really tracks. Dooku was his master. So another non-traditional Jedi, arguably.
Yeah, wow. Okay, that tracks for sure. So Obi-Wan's kind of the odd man out.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go in and, like, try to figure out who Dooku's master is. Let's cut it off there. But, right. But for the most part, it's with one, I guess, unbroken link in the chain. That's a fair assessment that she comes from a long tradition or long line of untraditional Jedi. One other thing you mentioned there about, like, Ahsoka compared to Gandalf the White. Do you know the lore reason why her lightsabers are the color they are, the white color?
No, I assumed that now that she has Hu Yang in tow and he's got a limitless reservoir of lightsaber parts, and you can see some lights, like dozens of lightsabers on the wall in the training room. So she could just, like, I feel like she could just keep recycling them. So I know she's got a lot at her disposal, but... No, I've been curious about the white color there.
So I don't know if this is an official thing anymore, but at least in the EU stuff, at least like in the books, like about Ahsoka and some of the extended universe stuff, it's because she went around after she left the Jedi Order. She went around basically fighting Sith and like fighting, or you know, maybe Inquisitors, and she would take their corrupted red kyber crystals and purify them. So her sabers are white because they are purified, formerly corrupted kyber crystals.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cool little detail about her.
Yeah, she's... I think they did they did her justice in this... In the show, in the episode, in this training montage.
And just to clear out all of like the training stuff, there's also a scene where they're, you know, drinking tea together or whatever, and she tries to Sabine is complaining that she can't use the Force, and Ahsoka's like, well, start small. And I do like that they bring up the question, but we really don't get a solid answer on, you know, she says the Force is in all things, and Sabine says, then why doesn't everybody use it? And Ahsoka admits, well, you know, talent is a component, but, we don't see Sabine successfully using the Force yet. So the question does hang in the air. Like, if you just want it real bad, can you move a small cup and then eventually move on to bigger things? Or do you have to have a certain amount of midichlorians?
Yeah, I mean, it's a...
Just the baseline.
It's this question that kind of hangs over the whole... season, which is why Sabine, you know, why train Sabine? It's kind of destined for failure, it seems like. That makes for good drama, good television, but and this might be a good segue to this episode cutting back to the New Republic fleet around Coruscant, but there is a very young, force sensitive child of a Jedi out there, right age, right aptitude, right talent. Right. And he's not being trained, but Sabine is. So it's that might be an answer for season two. But who, audience, I'm talking, of course, about Jason, who is the son of everyone's favorite Hera and Kanan Jarrus, a Jedi Knight who we lost in the Rebel series. But that brings us to Hera and Jason, and they're hanging out in the Rebel fleet trying to appeal to the New Republic politicians and say, hey, we need a bit of a task force here to investigate what's going on Setos, which is where Ahsoka and Sabine are headed right now.
Yeah, we got Chancellor Mothma and a bunch of senators, and they've called in Hera to talk about that. And before she goes in, her friend informs her that Ziono is there. What do you think of this guy, Ziono?
Yeah, it's curious. I was watching this with my wife, and we were like, you think he's like an Imperial loyalist? And I said, I think he's just a jackass. I think he's just kind of maybe a little drunk on his own power, or he's just got like a vendetta against Hera. Although I got to say, Hera didn't come with like the best presentation. Like, she should have had a PowerPoint presentation with maybe like a recording of Ahsoka being like, hey, I'm Ahsoka. I saved everyone. I'm a Jedi. This is what's happening. Can you send a couple X-Wings my way? But she kind of came unprepared. But yeah, the senator is just, he's kind of the, he's just that Republic bureaucrat who gets in the way, right?
Yeah, if he is an imperialist, an imperial sympathizer, whatever you want to call it, they're laying it on pretty thick.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think that he's just a jackass. I think Hera calls it out exactly. She's like, did you fight in the war, or did you just kind of wait to see which side the chips would fall on? And that shuts him up immediately. And I think she like really reads him for filth. And that's exactly what it is. It's not, I mean, you know, maybe I'll eat my words when season two comes out, but yeah, I don't think he's going to be like secretly a villain. I think it's just, he's a pompous jackass who has like an inferiority complex, maybe.
I think that's just a more interesting character, right? That it's not because he's just evil and an imperial. It's, he's got this baggage going on. And I'm sure you must have loved that when Hera dresses him down. Oh, I mean, how badass was that? But
they do drop.
Yeah. Oh, no, go for it.
They do drop the line that they've dropped multiple times, both in this show. They said it like almost word for word on The Mandalorian. Somebody says there are former Imperials on every level of the New Republic government. And they keep saying that as if they're proud of this fact and that it's not the very obvious reason that led to Episode 7 and everything that happened there, right?
Yeah, that's more of that world building, right? That subtext that Filoni keeps adding. I mean, Disney kind of set this up where we went from, what, Return of the Jedi to The Force Awakens, and there's this First Order. And so Filoni inherited, I guess, the thankless job of trying to explain the First Order. I think he's been doing a fairly good job, although sometimes it gets bogged down. Like, it's maybe in The Mandalorian before and in here, some it interrupts the pacing a little bit, but I guess it's an important thing to do to set the stage for what's to come.
Mm-hmm.
This scene frustrated me, though, because I know I was joking about her PowerPoint presentation, but I'm also frustrated by the writing in this is a little clunky, because if a general, a hero of the resistance, a hero of the rebellion came to you and said, listen, I just need a small task force to go investigate this thing, because if we don't, it could mean the return of one of our greatest enemies and a new war, just as we're recovering from the last one, just as we're licking our wounds. And the Senate's like, nah, I don't understand the no. I don't understand one that, like, Hera didn't make a more convincing case and allowed herself to get riled up by this senator, who was kind of painting it as more of like a personal desire to see the return of Ezra. And of course, that's part of it. But I also don't get how Mon Mothma and these senators couldn't spare a few resources just to check this out. Because, right, don't you think the risk versus reward, it just makes sense?
It's, yes. But I think it's another example of how, like, the New Republic is hoisted by their own petard, right? Their hands are tied by the bureaucracy that they created. You know, she's Chancellor Mothma. You could see a situation where she would be like, well, I'm the chancellor. I believe what the general's saying, so I'm going to allocate these resources for this purpose. But then that makes her no better than, you know, the emperor. So she kind of has to leave things up to a democratic process. And it just, in this case, Hera didn't convince the majority of the voters, and so they voted against it.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's one of those things where you're like, man, it's democracy in action, and it sucks when it doesn't go your way, but you don't want it to go the other way, right?
That's fair. Yeah. To quote It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Dennis, this is a perfect example of where democracy has failed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what it really is like it's the former Imperials at every level of the New Republic line. Like if they're at every level, then one it stands to reason that they're at this level and they're voting on things like this, and that they could sway the vote the way that they want to in order to sabotage from within this New Republic. So I don't know. I just think like it's embarrassing how much they've stepped in it and created this bureaucracy that has tied their own hands and also given their former enemies so much power to create an effective insurrection. And it's frustrating to watch. But yeah, I do also agree. Like I have a couple like criticisms of, I don't want to say of Hera, but of like the way that they wrote Hera. Cause I don't think it's totally true to her. You know, for one thing, losing her cool so easily, getting riled up by this guy. But also, counterpoint to her going rogue and taking the small contingent, she does get two pilots killed. And that is on her, you know, because she was leading that little mission.
Yeah, let's I know we're jumping into episode 4, but let's talk a little bit about that, because that really bothered me. One... Well, okay, so to fast forward to episode 4, even though she's denied the resources, Hera decides to go. The stakes are so high, she decides to go on her own to the Danab system to investigate this potential return of Thrawn, which is, okay, sure. I kind of like the character moment. She's a general, but she's clearly not happy behind a desk. You know, she's still wearing her flight gear. She wants to be flying. Like, that's really cool. But... she puts 5 X-Wings at risk. I mean, I guess they volunteered. I kind of get that. But worse, much worse, she brings her 12-year-old son along. That just boggles my mind. Hera would never do that. No self-respecting soldier or mother would do it. So that seemed like really out of character.
Well, I mean, Ezra was a kid, and like a kid, you know, at the start of Rebels, and she was basically mom, and she put him, well, not put him, but like allowed him to come along on danger. She would, you know, definitely put up some resistance against him, and then, you know, he'd probably just like sneak on board or whatever at first, but I don't know. I agree with you. It's in the real world, that's egregious and neglectful parenting. But in Star Wars, and like knowing that this kid is probably force sensitive and whatever and can handle himself, yeah, I don't know why I'm trying to make an argument for her endangering her own child and that being okay. I guess it wasn't the most egregious thing that she did.
No,
compared to other egregious things.
That's fair. And you're right. That family unit from Rebels was different ages, different vulnerabilities, and they kept going into battle and that kind of thing. But it just felt weird. I don't think they've quite figured out Hera in this series, right? Like I think the actress, I think Winstead, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, kind of is doing a good job, but some of the writing is not quite right for her just yet. And that decision seemed very strange.
It's because you want Hera behind the sticks. Like, you want to see her piloting and getting some action. But yeah, when they're literally just, you know, like tying her down and grounding her, you're like, oh no, this is a complete misuse of this character. So it is fun to see her like say, no, fuck that, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna do my thing and go be a badass pilot, along with Carson Teva. But then immediately she gets her ass handed to her and you're like, well, come on. yeah, because Hera is obviously at her best when she's doing crazy maneuvers and taking down Imperials. But we do see like a cool space battle not involving Hera, unfortunately, with Merrick and Shin leading this small group of 6 fighters that at first, like the first shot of these ships, I thought they looked like repurposed pod racers almost, or like they used parts from pod racers to make these spaceships. And I thought they were a pretty cool design. They... Ahsoka and Hu Yang and Sabine end up in the Danab system, and they get intercepted by these six ships. And there's some cool stuff with Sabine going down and taking the gunner seat. Again, like very, you know, Luke episode four in the Millennium Falcon. A lot of cool parallels that they peppered in throughout, not just this episode, but throughout the series, between Sabine and Luke. And she shoots down a couple, and then... Okay, before I get into it, I gotta ask your opinion on Ahsoka taking out the last couple ships, or I guess just one last ship with her lightsaber.
Oh, yeah. So, well, to rewind just a bit, I love the look of those ships. For me, it reminded me of, like, a World War II fighter plane. It had that kind of like a Messerschmitt, like one of those German planes. It kind of had the wings and like the fuselage structure of that, which makes sense because there's all this World War II imagery peppered throughout the Star Wars universe, right? The battle of the first Death Star. I think some of the shots and the editing was taken from some World War II movie. And then in the beginning of The Last Jedi, they've got that cool bombing run on like the huge... Star Destroyer, or I forgot what it's called. Not a Leviathan.
Star Killer Base?
It was the very beginning when they have like that bombing run over the ship.
In Last space. Jedi, yes.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, where they're dropping bombs in zero gravity.
I know, right? You have to suspend your disbelief. But I thought that was a cool nod to like the. There's always been some World War II imagery in the Star Wars galaxy. The fight, to answer your question, that was a bit much for me. You know, there's always these moments in Star Wars that are like, ooh, I don't know about that one. And Ahsoka, so it's badass, of course, Ahsoka going out on like the wing of her ship that's kind of dead in the water and just like slashing a fighter in the middle of space. Like, it's so cool. But I don't know how she got that spacesuit on so quickly, especially with her montrals there. And then it just kind of defies, like, if I was those fighter planes attacking, I would just like hang back and just keep shooting. They kind of moved in within slicing distance. So it was one of these two episodes had a few like kind of contrived things. That being one of them. I mean, it's cool to see Rosario Dawson as Ahsoka slashing through a ship hull in deep space, but it was a bit much for me. What did you think?
Yeah, it is a bit much. I think I'm a sucker for this kind of thing because it's just so cool, and I think it's like it is definitely implausible, and it's like one of those things where, you know, Ahsoka asks the DM, "Hey, can I try this?" And they're like, "If you roll a nat 20, I'll let you do it." And she rolled a nat 20. You know, it's it's like the one entire. I do appreciate that she wasn't just cutting down ship after ship. It was just the one ship. The rest of them got shot down by Sabine. So that makes it, I think, a little more digestible. But yeah, it is over the top. But I think it almost achieves being that kind of Star Wars over the top where it's just fun and you don't care. But I definitely accept your argument that it's a little too much.
Yeah, it felt kind of like that. But it was a quick moment in a long battle, and there was some good stuff in that battle with some Ahsoka Sabine stuff, where Ahsoka piloting that unnamed craft was being kind of haughty and arrogant a bit, you know, not like just saying like, "Hey, Sabine, you got it. You know what you're doing." And Sabine like calling out for help, and Hu Yang being like, "If you guys don't start communicating, we're all going to be dead." And that was a nice little moment. And then Ahsoka had this moment of humility and said, what does she say? I wrote it down here.
She said, "What do you need?"
Yeah. "What do you need?" That was a really cool moment between master and apprentice. Mm-hmm. And it also does speak to Ahsoka is a bit arrogant right now. Like, not overly, but I think just being alone for so long and being so confident in her powers, and her powers just so overshadow Sabine's to a huge degree. So that was a nice little moment. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Do you have anything else about this space battle? It does lead into the Purgles. Like, that's kind of how they get away. Once they get the ship moving again, they get closer to the planet, and they encounter a swarm, I guess a pod of Purgles, and these Cthulhu Eldritch Whales is what I wrote down. And they talk about, Balin and Morgan talk about how they used to follow the migration paths of early Jedi used to follow the migration paths of these Purgle, and that's kind of how they discovered hyperspace travel. And I guess reverse engineered it from them. Is that what you inferred from that?
Oh, I didn't quite get that. I did love the lore dump of, you know, like the ancient Jedi experiencing the Purgle, observing them, knowing the existence of faraway galaxies. And I gotta say, sometimes Filoni can be a bit too familiar. You know, it could be like, oh, these characters again. Oh, they're going back to Lothal. Oh, it's right. You know what I mean? But I gotta give credit where credit is due. The Purrgil, I think, are his creation, right? They were introduced in Rebels, right? They make an appearance in season 3 of The Mandalorian. Shameless plug for that podcast series. Go check that out on Robots versus Dinosaurs. At which point, when I first saw them, I didn't know what they were because I hadn't watched Rebels. But they are so interesting, so otherworldly, so alien, so magical. That, along with this new galaxy, which Filoni has invented and now has explored, or will explore as we get into episodes 6, 7, 8, it's this new horizon for Star Wars. I'm so excited about it. The Purrgil and this new galaxy, they go hand in hand, and I just love the Purrgil. I can't get enough of them. I can't get how unknowable they are. Like, they just exist beyond the Jedi, beyond the Sith, beyond the Force, beyond the galaxy. They are just, I love them. I love what they represent for the Star Wars canon galaxy. And going full fanboy here, but I love the Purrgil.
No, I agree. I think they're an awesome creation. And the way that this show in particular is using them, and it's great how it ties into Rebels, because that's, you watched it more recently than I did, but I'm pretty sure that's how Ezra and Thrawn get taken off the board in the first place, right? Ezra does something to get, yeah.
Yeah, he summons them somehow after they meet them at this, like, mining station in deep space, and
somehow Palpatine.
Okay.
Different character,
different show, but they, like, wrap their like, tentacles around Thrawn's Star Destroyer, just take off. Now we know they took off and went to this faraway galaxy. But there's something special.
Mm-hmm. And then the last thing in this episode was Balin and Morgan talking, and she's just like, hunt them down. Or no, man, I got that way wrong. It's Balin. He's like planet side, and he has his mercenaries with him.
Yep.
And he's like, oh, we found we know where their ship has landed. Hunt them down. Bum, bum, bum. Awesome. Anything else to say about episode 3, Time to Fly?
Not really. Only that this was probably, upon rewatch, I realized this was probably one of my least favorite episodes, just because it felt a bit like, I hesitate to use the word filler, but it just felt like something to, it felt like a vehicle to get some characters to where they need to be. And then this next one, Fallen Jedi, I think was one of my actually favorite upon rewatch, because the themes, it took its time, it explored the themes. This third one, though, a little too much action for me, a little too much scene setting. It was probably one of my least favorite.
Yeah, episode 3 is very much like a setup episode. It's not the most exciting, and it has, the least interesting title of all the episodes so far, also. Time to Fly.
Yeah, not very exciting.
Yeah, I think that is, like, a thing Anakin says during the prequels at least once. Maybe that's why they call it that, but it doesn't make it more interesting. It's just a bad title.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the better episode, episode 4, Fallen Jedi. This one's directed by Peter Ramsey. A lot of awesome Ray Stevenson, a lot of cool Ivana Sokno stuff. We get some fantastic smirk work from Diana Lee and Asanto. Yeah, she's given Saturday morning cartoon in the best way.
She should trademark that smirk.
Yep. If there is a, which I'm sure there is, like an action figure of Morgan Elsbeth that should have that smirk on its, painted on its plastic face. Okay, so this one starts with Hu Yang is repairing the ship. The comms are down. They're trying to get back in touch with Phoenix. What's Phoenix? Phoenix leader is Hera. Right. Call sign. And they're not able to get in touch with anybody. And Ahsoka and Sabine have like a little back and forth about the map. And their mission is to find the map, ideally to help them use it to get to Ezra. But Ahsoka is having some second thoughts, and she says, you know, might be better to leave Ezra than stranded than to allow Thrawn to return as the heir to the Empire.
Yeah.
And she says something about, like, you need to do the right thing even when your emotions or your feelings want you to do the other thing. And where this conversation kind of ends on her saying, Sabine, can I count on you? And Sabine saying, you know you can, which is a lie. Judges, yep, that was a lie. The judges tell us that was a lie.
Yeah, definitely some foreshadowing there. That scene, Ahsoka reminded me of Obi-Wan, right? The whole, like, it's not important what we care about. It's important for the order, for balance, for the galaxy, for, you know, for peace. And Sabine just clearly still hung up on Ezra and hung up on kind of restoring any sense of family in her life.
And they tie that back into Anakin Skywalker directly, you know, if not for him following his passion, his feelings more than doing the right thing, all of this wouldn't have happened.
Absolutely.
So we do get another cool exchange between Morgan and Baylan, where she's like, do I detect a hint of fear in your voice when they're getting ready to go hunt down these planet side Jedi and Padawan? And she says, no, experience.
Yeah. Stevenson, again, rest in peace, Ray Stevenson, but he can really, with one word, he achieves a lot. He did that previously in episodes 1 and 2 when he was, you know, talking about, trying to save Ahsoka because there's so few Jedi left, but just saying experience, there's so much weight to that word, so much subtext to that word. I think you and I are both going to just geek out about that character for the next 45 minutes, right? Because he really... Baylan Skoll is just one of the best additions to this whole series.
Well, let's get into it. Let's talk Baylan
Skoll.
Let's
do it.
So later, there's another like back and forth where Morgan is putting the map sphere on the sphere pedestal, and she like puts her finger over it in some green magic, and it creates that whole big projection around them of the star map. And this, I need to know your thoughts about this. Baylan looks at all of this, watches her do that with her finger, and he goes, witchcraft. This dude is a Jedi, like, or was a Jedi, you know, has magic powers himself. He lives in a world of incredible technology, and he looks at this and he's like, witchcraft. Like, what did you take from that reaction?
Yeah, that's funny. I also focused in on that because, again, a lot in that one word. I sensed some disdain in the line reading. I don't know if you did.
Yeah, weirdly.
Right? Which is like, oh, well, what does that mean? Like, maybe he's still like, I'm a Jedi. I once was a Jedi. He still has a lot of affinity for maybe not the Order, but the friends and the meaning it brought his life. And he's known the Force and explored the Force his whole life. And witchcraft, maybe he looks down on it. It seemed like a combination of, like, disdain, but also maybe fear. So it was just an interesting, line reading, especially because he's so eager to enter this world of witchcraft. That's where he's headed. Although witchcraft is not the end of his journey. But, yeah, I thought that was a really interesting line. How did you dissect it?
Well, it's interesting to say that it's not the end of his journey, because he goes to this planet where, you know, in the next few episodes, we're going to see, like, where they end up. And it's Morgan L's best friends are there, the rest of her, like, witch coven. And he is looking for some source of power on that planet, which we talked a little bit about, like, what's the difference between, like, the schools of magic when it comes to the Force versus the green-coated Morgan Elsbeth witchcraft. And is it the same source? Is it all just different names for the same thing? I think you and I both agree, like, it's not. It's kind of two different sources of magic, or whatever name you want to give it. But I do wonder, like, when he's exploring that planet, is that a major center of power for the witches because of something he's going to discover? Or is it something that's going to tie them all together? Like, this is a common source of both the Force and this witchcraft thing. And that's what he's seeking out.
Yeah, I've got a theory, which I don't know if it's appropriate to share, but it's that I think we talked about a little bit about Mortis last episode and about how that appears in the Clone Wars. And how Anakin has a connection to there is like the chosen one. And Mortis, for those uninitiated, it's what the father, the son, and the daughter. And it's this like trinity. It's also mentioned at the end of Rebels, right? It's like the dark side, the light side, and like the middle. And it's the rules, the parties, like the groups that have defined Star Wars for so long don't really make sense there. It's not Sith and Jedi. It's like a more... It's just like the home of the Force. And I think my theory is that there's some connection on that witch planet to Mortis and to that power. And I think that's what Baylan is looking for, to kind of maybe restart the galaxy, where it's not just an eternal cycle of war, peace. That's my hot take.
Yeah, it's the Daenerys in Game of Thrones saying, like, I'm going to break the wheel, right?
Yeah, I think...
I'm just going to stop the wheel. I'm going to break it.
I think that's kind of his journey, that it goes beyond the Jedi, goes beyond the Night Sisters.
Yeah. There's another thing Morgan says, like, you know, you have to have faith, because he's worried about, you know, if the calculations are off by one slight bit, we'll be lost in the depths of the void, because they're, you know, using this incredible hyperspace power that's never been used, I guess, on a ship before. Purgles obviously use it whenever they want to, but so he's like, oh, you know, we could end up lost in the depths of the void. And she says, have faith, and he says, faith, I lost that a long time ago. You and I talked in the last episode a bit about, like, where do we think Baylan was during Order 66? Like, what do you think made him so jaded and disaffected? And it's interesting. It's really interesting how they put him up against Ahsoka, and how much they're at odds with each other, because there's a world for sure where, like, I think if Baylan had watched that episode of the Clone Wars and seen why Ahsoka left the Jedi Order, and, like, knew, you know, the whole thing about her getting framed and then letting her take the fall and whatnot, I don't think he would be as antagonistic towards her. But he, when they end up fighting later, he's like, your legacy is death and destruction, just like your master's. And she's, you know, she's like, is that, I forget exactly what she says, but he's like, oh, is that why you abandoned Anakin? Is that why you left the Order and abandoned them for your own selfish reasons? And it's like, well, he just, that implies to me, he just can't possibly be aware of what the truth was, right? There's no way he would know why she actually left the Jedi Order. Because I think if he did, he'd respect it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. He definitely doesn't know exactly what was going on, right? I mean, he was in the Jedi Order, but I think he was probably on the periphery, you know, with people like Kanan, who was younger at the time. But everyone knew Anakin just because, like, right, everyone would know, you know, he would be a celebrity, right? But that fight scene at the end is interesting, not only for its, I love the choreography of it, but I do kind of get, especially after rewatching that episode, why they're so at odds, because Ahsoka, despite having walked away from the Order and kind of renouncing the Jedi, and I don't think she considers herself a Jedi, right? She still kind of wants to, I think she's still beholden to that time period. She still wants to kind of restore what the Jedi maybe represent, right? Even if she's not, you know, a card-carrying member of the Jedi Order. And I think Baylan just wants to, he wants it gone. It's like, that can't come back. That world doesn't exist anymore. He says some line about you need to destroy in order to create. So
yeah.
So I think they're at odds because Ahsoka's looking backwards, I think, a bit. And Baylan's looking forward to this kind of new dynamic that only he has kind of a vision for. So it kind of makes sense that they're at odds, even though they both consider themselves outside of the Jedi Order.
There's also just a lot of storytelling in the way that they face off with each other, because
yes,
they both kind of start off in the same fighting stance, like holding the hilt of their lightsabers in very similar ways. I'm so glad that you finished Rebels, because there are two, I think, direct references to my favorite episode of Rebels in this fight. Both in this fight and her fight with Merrick earlier. This is a huge spoiler. Listeners, if you haven't watched, I think it's the final season of Rebels. It might be the season before it. But there's an arc where Darth Maul, somehow Darth Maul has returned. And not his brother, but, you know, actually Darth Maul, formerly with spider legs, and then he got them magically restored by Night Sisters, and he has regular legs. He comes back, he finds out that there's some chosen one, some kind of prophetic figure on Tatooine that he has to go and kill. And Obi-Wan is there, of course, to protect Luke Skywalker, a baby little Luke. And so they have this standoff, and it's the shortest lightsaber battle that I think we see in all of Star Wars, but it's also, I think, the most symbolic and the coolest one, because what it is Obi-Wan and Darth Maul stand off from each other at a short distance. They start out in these poses. They both, like, shift their pose a little bit, and then they go at each other, and Darth Maul does this move that he did to kill Qui-Gon Jinn, where he swings his double-sided blade, shoves the hilt into the face of his opponent to distract them, and that's how he killed Qui-Gon, was he stunned him and then came around and stabbed him through the chest. Obi-Wan Kenobi has had literally decades to think about that moment, to think about why Qui-Gon lost that fight, and he sees Maul going into that stance, he knows exactly what move he's going to use, and he just does this downward slash to cut the hilt in half and simultaneously cut down Maul, and it's the end of Darth Maul. And it's like, the time it took me to describe that is longer than the fight itself.
Yeah.
It's literally just pop, 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 slash, fight's over. What's cool about that is it's so much more realistic than like a protracted, ongoing parry, block, parry, swing, like, battle. And it's more akin to how samurai actually battled.
Absolutely.
Like, in real life. Most of the fight was done in the mind, and it was done before the actual swords clashed, where it's just, I'm looking at your stance, your footwork, the way you're holding your sword, and I'm going to adjust my stance based on that. And then when we come together, it's kind of already decided, like, based on who has the superior positioning. Right?
Lou, great minds think alike, because I didn't think of the Maul-Obi-Wan fight, although we could spend probably an hour just talking about that one scene, right? Like, you're right. The symbolism of it is amazing. It was just...
Well, it's how Ahsoka takes down Merrick.
Right.
Like, they do battle for a little bit, but then he starts doing the spinny helicopter blade thing and comes at her. And she just, in one thing, she just waits for the right moment, gets in between the spinning blades, and just slices him down the middle.
Yeah, and you compared it to a samurai battle. I didn't think of Rebels, but I did think of Seven Samurai in that scene. So there's a scene early on in Seven Samurai, before all the samurai go to rescue the band, you know, rescue the village and fend off the bandits, where it follows a couple samurai watching like a match between two other samurai, and they're like on a hilltop looking down on it, and it's one samurai with like holding the katana in like a lower position, and one holding it in like a high position above his head. And like the younger samurai turns to the older experienced samurai and says, "Who do you think will win?" And the older one says, "Isn't it obvious?" And then 1 second, one guy falls, the other guy is standing. And that immediately thought of this. I thought of this when I was watching that scene between Ahsoka and Merrick. I'm like, is it obvious that Ahsoka is going to win when she holds the sword up and Merrick's spinning it around? So totally agree. It had that spirit, that essence of Japanese cinema, but also of kind of samurai fights. And and I love that you brought up the Obi-Wan Maul thing, because that's a great parallel too.
So then when she's squaring off with Baylan, we get a little bit of that too. And this is what I was talking about earlier. It's so delicious. Like, they give you time to chew on it and you want to. They're standing off from each other. They're both doing like the, you know, sort of blade at a 45 degree angle, both hands on the hilt. And then they start like trading off different stances and like doing, yeah. I wish that I could speak eloquently about like which form, whether it's Suresu or Vapad or Atar. I know the names of them. I just can't tell you like when they go into each form. I'm sure a more well-versed Star Wars nerd could. But it's very like, it's very dramatic. It's very cool. I think it's the kind of thing like I want to see. I want to see them clashing and like actually swing, jump, block, parry, all that stuff too. But I don't know. All of the setup for the fight is even cooler in a way.
I love that final fight, and it reminded me of another movie. So the Merrick Ahsoka fight reminded me of Seven Samurai. The fight between Baylan and Ahsoka reminded me of... Have you seen Rob Roy? I don't want to spoil anything. So there,
no, but you can spoil it.
Without spoiling anything, there's a fight in Rob Roy between two people with Liam Neeson. There you go. So Qui-Gon's also in there, brandishing in this instance a broadsword, not a lightsaber. But there's a fight between two people, one of whom has a rapier and one of whom has a broadsword. And the two swords kind of represent their personalities, one more like faster, more devious, one matter of fact, broad, stout, sturdy. And it's an amazing fight. I recommend Rob Roy to anyone. But that kind of reminded me of Baylan and Ahsoka, because Ahsoka has a blade that kind of looks like a katana. And Baylan's is almost like a claymore. I kind of got that claymore vibe. Mm-hmm. It was like more strength, slow movement, and Ahsoka was kind of rapid slicing. I love when a sword fight kind of represents the two personalities at war. So, the climax of this episode is really great.
Yeah, and the way that it all starts with Merrick and Shin show up and they're squaring off against Ahsoka and Sabine. And so, you know, it's obvious, like, who's going to pair off with who. Sabine takes Shin on again, rematch. And this is kind of wild. I thought that when they break off, when Ahsoka handles Merrick and takes him down, she's like, Sabine's like, go ahead, go get the map. I can handle this. I'm like, can you? That's been proven wrong
right
before. Judges. Yep. That was also a lie, Sabine. although she does, honestly, in this fight, she does, in a very cool way. They start out with her just trying, you know, I'm going to fight like a Mandalorian. I'm just using my blasters. And against your sabers, they're just fighting. And then they get to a point where, like, Shin uses the force to push her back or, like, slam her into a tree. So she drops her blasters, and then they're fighting with the green saber against the orange saber, which just looks very cool on this backdrop with all these red trees. And then Sabine does a very cool move. I thought it was a very cool move where she's like down and she pushes her hand out and Shin like flinches like, uh-oh, she's going to do some force shit on me. And then she realizes, wait a minute, you can't force push. You can't even do a basic thing. You have no power. And Sabine just like shoots the little Mandalorian birds missiles out of her wrist rocket and I think breaks her lightsaber or something. Because that kind of decides the fight. And then Shin throws a smoke bomb because she has some tricks up her sleeve too, which is cool. But yeah, I know, like, I mentioned, like, she's fighting like a Mandalorian. There's also a moment earlier when Hu Yang gets attacked by the HK droid, where she's, what I've noticed between this show and the Mandalorian is the way Mandalorians fight is they just tank shots. They're like, yeah, I'm going to get shot. I'm not even going to try to avoid them because my Beskar armor can just take it. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, definitely. Totally. Yes. Sabine runs down the ramp and immediately like takes a shot to the shoulder. She holds up her wrist gauntlets like Wonder Woman and to deflect a few shots. So yeah, they're in the fray immediately.
One other thing about Hu Yang is when he gets ambushed by that HK droid, it just puts its hand over his mouth to shut him up. And I'm like, I think I thought about it too much because I was like, is that wrong? Like, is that dumb? But where else would his speaker be if not in the logical place where a human speaker would be?
that scene is like quietly one of my favorite in the whole series. It's more of like Ahsoka's reaction. So Hu Yang is under the ship repairing it, trying to get everything back online, the communications systems, the hyperdrive, et cetera, et cetera. And he's ambushed by an HK droid. They have this kind of tussle. He fights with all those forearms, at least forearms. Really cool. And when he realizes that he's overpowered and that he can't call for help because his mouth device is covered, he really ingeniously pulls like a wire on the ship to basically turn off all the systems he was just repairing. And there's this great moment. I loved it when it first happened. I loved it even more where it cuts from this fight outside the ship to inside the ship and all the lights go down. And Sabine says, she's sort of exasperated. And she says, I want to get this right.
He made it worse.
Yeah, that daft droid made it worse. And at the same time, Ahsoka is already moving toward the ship door saying he wouldn't. And she runs out and her sabers go up. So it's just this great little moment where it tells you so much about Ahsoka, about Hu Yang and about their relationship, right? Hu Yang doesn't mess up. He's like a perfectionist. Ahsoka knows that. Mm-hmm. And if something went wrong, it means something is going wrong outside. It's not Hu Yang's incompetence. And she's ready to join the fight. It's just like 5-second scene, but it says so much about those two characters. That's like low key one of my favorite moments in the whole series.
That was good. The fight between Baylan and Ahsoka ends with Ahsoka keeps trying to get to the map. She ends up grabbing it and like burns her hand. And they square off. Sabine shows up, or no, I'm sorry, Shin shows up, and Ahsoka immediately is distraught because she thinks like, oh man, I trusted my Padawan to take on this fight, and she got killed, and that's on me. And so she gets like, she gets angry and taps into a little bit of dark side and like slams her against a rock, which in turn makes Baylan angry.
Yep.
And once he gets angry, it seems to make him more powerful, and he just easily overpowers her, starts doing huge heavy swings at her, and like fights her to the edge of that cliff. Then Sabine does show up. She is alive, but Ahsoka's kind of in a bad position. She's already beaten at this point, and she tells Sabine to destroy the map. Baylan takes the opportunity to knock her off the cliff, and Sabine doesn't destroy the map like she should have. And Baylan tells her, you should have. You should have listened to your master.
Yeah, that, there's a lot going on there, right? A lot. And I'm glad you and I think, read that fight scene the same way. One thing, just to step back from this episode, this series, I think we could all agree that it's really hard to tell, like, which Jedi is more powerful than the other one. Because, like, you know, everyone's beaten everyone else at, like, different moments in time, right? So it's like, could Vader beat Palpatine? Windu did beat Palpatine. Like, Obi-Wan did beat Vader, but then Vader beat Obi-Wan. And, you know, like, it's hard to tell. At one point, Ahsoka beat Darth Maul, which is actually pretty damn impressive, at the end of the final season of Clone Wars. So it's like, where does Ahsoka stand? Like, where is Ahsoka on the tier list, if you're going to make a tier list of Jedi power? I think she's pretty damn high, right? She's really up
there. She's high on my list, for sure.
So I think, would you agree she was winning that fight when she grabbed the map? But then your interpretation, I think, was right. She burned her hand, first of all. Then she had totally distraught because she thought Sabine was dead. Then she gave into the dark side when she really viciously, violently throws Baylan's apprentice into the rocks. Like, that was intense.
Darth Billie Eilish.
Yeah, Darth Billie Eilish. Shin, right. So I think your reading and mine was the same, that she was unbalanced, she was angry, she was in pain. And that's kind of how Baylan got the jump on her. Because I would guess, like, in a fair fight, Ahsoka would win. But I don't know. It's always difficult to tell who's stronger than whom.
Well, that question hangs in the air because they do get a rematch in a later episode. And if I remember right, Baylan easily handles her again, right? Like, he wins that fight.
She might escape from that. I'll have to rewatch that episode. But you're right.
We'll relitigate that on a future episode for sure. Yeah. But you're right, like, it is kind of, it does kind of come down to positioning. You know, it's the samurai thing. It comes down to positioning, it comes down to who has which goal and who is more balanced in their emotions at that moment. Because I do think, if she hadn't burned her hand, if her goal wasn't to grab the map, if she wasn't distracted by trying to get past him, if it was just like a one-on-one cage match to the end, I don't know. I could see Ahsoka winning it because she's more... Well, I don't know, but in my mind, she's more skilled at dueling. But I don't know, maybe Baylan is, and we just haven't seen everything he can do.
Yeah, I'll have to look forward to that rewatch of that future episode, because you mentioned that, and it does sound right. So anyway, it was a well-choreographed scene, rich in, you know, theme and metaphor, and I really enjoyed that whole end. And then, as you said, Sabine makes kind of the wrong choice. Let me ask you this, though. I was reading the Wikipedia summary for this episode, and in it, let me get that for you. Wikipedia, right? Can you trust it? let's see. Okay. Here we go. This is Baylan Skoll. When Skoll sends Ahsoka plummeting to the ocean, Ren holds the map at gunpoint, but Skoll manipulates her into handing it over by promising to take her to Bridger. Now, I object to the word manipulates. Do you think that's fair? I think this was Sabine's decision. I think it was, you could argue, the wrong decision. But I don't know if that was a manipulation. I feel like that doesn't do justice to Sabine's agency.
That's a really interesting position on that, because I actually agree with the word manipulate. I wrote down some of that dialogue. He once he sees that she's really going to do it, she's really going to shoot the map, he's like, I know that you think Ezra Bridger is the only family you have left. Again, judges, that's a lie. Jason literally calls her Auntie, Auntie Sabine. It's clear, like, she still talks to Hera now and then and interacts with her. And they are, for sure, family.
Absolutely.
Zeb is doing whatever, but, like, he's still around. He's still part of the Resistance or the New Republic. Unfortunately, he doesn't show up on this show, which is, my heart aches for that. But I assume, you know, every once in a while, Sabine and Zeb get together for a drink or some Mantel mix or whatever. But yeah, I think that's Baylan manipulating her. I think he pauses. He like closes his eyes like he's tapping into her thoughts, right? Or her feelings. And then he starts going on about like, oh yeah, you think Ezra Bridger's the only family you have left. And then I wanted to ask you about this line in particular. He says, your family died on Mandalore because your master didn't trust you. What do you know? Do you know like exactly what that's referring to?
I want to say in future episodes, they talk a little bit about that. Maybe it's when Ezra and Sabine are talking, but I think her family perished when the Empire like carpet bombed Mandalore, right?
Like, yeah, glassed it. That's in an episode of Rebels. I remember that. Like, it opens with, you see, like, burning skulls and everything on the ashes of Mandalore.
But maybe it was something like Sabine wanted to go home and Ahsoka didn't let her. That part, I don't remember from future episodes. Maybe we'll have to relitigate that as well. But it's clear that, like, her mother, her brother, other extended family, they're all gone. And it's really just...
Yeah.
It's Ahsoka, although in that moment she probably thinks Ahsoka's dead too. Hera, Chopper, Jason. Yeah.
And I'll give him credit for this. Like, I do think all of that was manipulation, but I will give him credit when he's like, you know, you have my word that if you come with us willingly, you won't be harmed. You'll get to see your friend Ezra. And he makes good on that promise when Shin starts force choking her. And he's like, stop. I gave her my word, and unlike other people, I keep my word. Yeah. Unlike other Robin Hoods, I speak English accent.
Yeah, he's honorable. You gotta love that. You gotta love an honorable villain. That's like the best kind. Here's my question for you then. Manipulate, I still object. I think he read her mind for sure. There's that pause. He like closes his eyes. It's actually really great nonverbal acting by Stevenson. Like, clearly he's like, and I'm sure in that moment Sabine was like, all her thoughts were focused on Ezra and like all the pain, so it was probably easy to read that amplified thought. And I do think he's like, but I don't, my theory, my feeling is this, he's just like reflecting back to her what her thoughts are. For me, it's less like she was going to pull the trigger and he walked her back from that. I'm not sure she was ever going to pull the trigger.
Interesting.
But I get...
Interesting.
That's part of the fun, right? We'll never know.
Yeah. Because then he destroys it with his lightsaber, and he's like, no one will be following us.
Yeah.
So takes the piece entirely off the board. The episode ends with... And I do want to go back to one quick thing, but the episode, just to wrap this part of it up, it ends with Ahsoka waking up on like this hard light bridge, and she hears somebody say Snips, and there's really only one person that calls her that, and then we see young Anakin with some, you know, age reducing technology.
Yep.
And he's like, I didn't expect to see you so soon. Yeah, any thoughts about, I guess we'll talk a lot about that in the next episode, but do you have any thoughts on that little moment?
That was sweet. You know, I gotta say, I don't know how you feel about this. I'd actually love to hear what you think about it. I think they did Anakin pretty dirty in the prequels. You know, it's such an important character. And I think Christensen bears too much of the brunt of the criticism for that.
Yep.
He had a thankless job. I mean, George Lucas, as much as I love him, he was a bit of a lazy director on the set of episodes 1, 2, and 3. So not only did you didn't have a director who was like coaching you, mentoring you, but you had to act opposite a lot of green screens, a lot of tennis balls representing an alien. Christensen just like, I don't know if really the only people who came out well are like, you know, amazingly talented actors like Christopher Lee and Ewan McGregor. Like they could overcome that. But I think a lot of the actors in the prequels didn't come out well. Mm-hmm. So Anakin wasn't written well. Just like his turn to the dark side wasn't really handled very well in Revenge of the Sith, which is, you could argue, one of the most pivotal moments in the entire Star Wars saga, probably the most. But I got to give it to Filoni and team. They have, across Clone Wars, they rehabilitated that character so much, where Anakin became one of my favorite characters. My wife and I watched the whole Clone Wars series, and like, fiercely loyal, amazing fighter, caring to a fault, but also then dark and violent and just quick to anger, but also quick to protect the people he loves. Like, just an interesting layered character. So when he appeared at the end of this, I'm like, this is going to be Filoni's Anakin. It's not going to be Lucas's Anakin. And so when he said Snips, I got a little emotional. Like, that the relationship between Anakin and Ahsoka was so well developed and explored in the Clone Wars that when that was the tease at the end of this episode, and I was really excited to see where it went. But what are your thoughts on Anakin as portrayed by Christensen and as portrayed by the animators and the voice actors in Clone Wars?
I completely agree. He was done dirty. Hayden Christensen was done a little bit dirty by, you know, Lucas's directing and also his editing decisions. I heard, this might be apocryphal, but I heard like a interview snippet where he said, like, you know, I did a take for one of these scenes and I didn't feel 100% about it. And I asked if we could do another take. And Lucas was like, no, we got to keep moving. And it was only like two takes for this one very pivotal scene. And it's the one that, like, one of those was the one where it stayed in. And it was like, well, that's kind of how he was being directed. He's a good actor. You've seen him in other movies. Like, he's a very good actor. So I do think it's a thing where he was just not directed well. And I do love that Dave Filoni in these live action shows is redeeming him very much. You know, I don't know if Filoni had anything to do with the Obi-Wan show, but huge, huge redemption arc for Hayden Christensen. Like, kind of a second chance for him to show his skill and his how good he is. I also agree that Filoni really told a better story of Anakin's fall to the dark side in the Clone Wars cartoon than all of the prequel movies combined. And I think the way it ties into Ahsoka so directly is Ahsoka being betrayed by the Jedi Order and being allowed to take the fall for the sabotage that she was blamed and imprisoned for erroneously. Her decision to leave, and not when they were like trying to extend a hand and being like, well, of course we'll accept you back. And she's like, well, I don't accept. I'm walking away from all this. I think that moment does more to explain Anakin's fall to the dark side and rejecting the Jedi Order and wanting to take them all down than anything we saw in episodes 1, 2, or 3.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight. Yeah, right. That, like, there was some trust broken when that happened. Because he is so loyal to Ahsoka, to Padme. Like, he's loyal to people, clearly above the Order. The inverse of Obi-Wan, right? Which is... But yeah, you're right. I'm so glad to see Christensen get a second chance here with the Star Wars fandom. And Obi-Wan, great stuff. And yeah, next episode we'll be getting a lot of Hayden Christensen, a lot of Anakin.
You just said it, though. The loyalty to people over the right thing to do. That's exactly what Ahsoka's trying to impart to Sabine at the beginning of this episode of this show. You know, she's like, sometimes it's more important to do the right thing than your personal feelings. And Sabine literally chooses people. She chooses Ezra over that.
Yep.
I do think, and season two is really gonna expand on it, I do think she is ultimately justified. Ezra Bridger is probably gonna be so pivotal, you know, to bringing down Thrawn. Same time, though, you know, I'm kind of going in circles with my own argument. It's also a problem they created by allowing Thrawn to come back, so Ahsoka was also right. But, you know, it's shades of gray, and I think that's what Filoni's interested in exploring. One last thing was just, like, going back to the moment when Hera shows up. Jason says, I've got a bad feeling. And Carson Teva and his, like, small squadron of X-Wings, they get holdoed, basically. Like, this is my, like, criticism of this is... I don't think Hera would make this mistake and just see this ship. Well, I guess maybe they don't know it's a ship, but whatever. It does have the design of a hyperspace ring, which we saw in the prequel eras. Visually, I think, especially as a pilot, you would recognize, okay, that's what this is, just on a grander scale. And when it starts warming up and they're directly in its path, what do they think they're going to do with their small X-Wings by just standing in its way? Why wouldn't they make some kind of evasive maneuver to get out of the way of it? But it, you know, jumps to hyperspace, which they do take pains in throughout the episode to show. It takes a lot of time for it to warm up. I don't know. It bugged me that they just get holdoed. She hyperspaces through them, and we lose. I wrote down, like, I don't know if we got any names of these pilots, but I just wrote down Rodian, black guy, girl, and then a guy that kind of looks like Wedge, question mark. It's not Wedge, but... and the Rodian and the black guy, unfortunately, are the ones that get killed.
Yeah, it's kind of this tragic little scene where they crash in, like, totally unsuspecting, crash into each other. And you're right, it's... Hera didn't take her medication that morning or something. Like, she just didn't seem like herself. But you did mention there's this cool little moment where Jason turns to his mom, and instead of uttering the famous Star Wars line, "I've got a bad feeling about this," says, what was it exactly?
I've got a bad feeling. Yeah.
Which, very cool, and also kind of said, like, foreboding, foreshadowing, and also speaks to his Force sensitivity, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else about these two episodes, Time to Fly and Fallen Jedi, before we move on to Lou's Big Three?
No, I think just three I could take or leave. Four I really enjoyed for its staging and its theme work. So one okay episode, one pretty good one.
Yeah. And I think, like, this being the midpoint of the season, this is a good ending for, like, the halfway point. Like, this is a great setup. We see exactly where this is going. Sabine is with the enemy, like, in their clutches, and they're jumping through to this second galaxy, and it just sets up so much promise that I think pays off really well in the latter half. So yeah, well, I'm excited to get to those. And now that brings us to our next section of the show. Ryan, sing the theme for us.
Lou's Big Three, it's you and me. We're going to have fun with Lou's Big Three.
Thank you, Ryan, with backing by John Williams. Just fantastic as always. I tried to book Cy Snoodles for that, but she wasn't available. And also...
Figuring Dan in the modal nodes?
Figuring Dan, the other agent, just wouldn't pick up the phone. But you know, we still have Ryan on retainer, and he does a great job with that theme song. So thank you, Ryan. So Lou's Big Three, number one, Evan. This is a dumb question, so I put it first.
Okay. I never know what to expect with these questions, man.
Is Mon full-on just a name, like a pronoun, or is it an honorific of some sort? Because you got Mon Mothma, but you also have the Mon Calamari. Is there any sort of link between those two? Is it a naming convention, or is that just a coincidence? The way that Sabine Wren and Kylo Ren, you add a W. And
I'm going to go with coincidence. I think Mon is her first name, and Mon Calamari is just coincidentally the name of that species.
Okay. But, dumb question out of the way. Go ahead.
But speaking of Mon Mothma, I think, apologies for not knowing the actress, but the actress who plays Mon Mothma, I think, does a really good job. Very similar to the small screen time the character got in Return of the Jedi, and just has that, like, that gravity, presence of like a career civil servant. Just has that vibe. So I think the Mon Mothma actress is doing a good job.
Well said. Yeah, she shows up in a couple scenes in Rogue One as well, and I think it's great that they've, like, kept her from the prequels, and she's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, Lou's Big Three number two. Okay, this is a serious thought that I had, but it's going to sound dumb.
hit me with it.
Can you explain to me why human genetics are so much stronger than Twi'lek genetics? Because
Jason?
First of all, I didn't know that, until I watched Rebels, I didn't know that a human and a Twi'lek could have a baby together. They do. And really the only combination of those genes is that Jason's hair is kind of green. That's it.
Okay. I'm so glad you brought this up because this bothers me. I saw him with the green hair. I'm like, that's it? That's Hera's contribution? But it also doesn't make sense in the Star Wars canon because, and having just watched Bad Batch, I was reminded of this. In an early season of the Clone Wars, Rex and like a platoon find this deserter on some backworld planet. Remember this guy?
Yep.
A clone deserter who is kind of a hero, but he marries, or he has a relationship with a Twi'lek and has two children, and the two children are clearly Twi'lek. So there is, there's a precedent in the Star Wars universe for, I guess, a human male, based on Jango Fett, right? So a human male and a Twi'lek female having children, and the children are visibly Twi'lek. And yet, when a human male, Kanan, and a Twi'lek female, Hera, have a child, it's visibly human with green hair. So that immediately bothered me because I feel like it should be a Twi'lek. Like those genes would take over more. But so I'm so glad you brought it up because I'm very confused about it.
Yeah, maybe like instead of two Leku, maybe just like one like a ponytail. Some compromise, something. Midpoint, something, yeah. Something. Yeah, not just green hair.
So I think they botched that. I don't know if they're like, we spent all the prosthetic budget on like on Ahsoka and on Hera. Like we got, it's got to be a human with green hair. I don't know.
I get that it's much, much easier from a production standpoint. Cause if that kid is going to become a bigger character, maybe in season two or in future things, they made it easier on themselves, all right. Lou's big three, number three. Evan, Hu Yang versus General Grievous, who you got?
This is a one-to-one fight, like in an open, like Final Destination Smash Brothers arena kind of thing?
Yes, and I want to add some stipulations to this, because we see Hu Yang getting handled in this episode, and he needs to call for help and everything, but arguably, he got ambushed. He did hold his own, like, he did square off with this HK assassin droid for a little bit, but he wasn't equipped for the fight either, and when we see him training with Sabine, he's got the four lightsaber hilts that he's holding when they're doing the Bakken training, and here's my argument. He knows every single fighting stance. It's literally programmed into him. He could read his opponent and know exactly what they're about to do, and maybe not exactly like a Jedi could, but he can anticipate and he knows every block and every counter for every maneuver. It's just, again, programmed into him. And he has the benefit of he's not fighting a Jedi who has that advantage that could read their opponent's thoughts. Grievous does not actually have any force powers. So in a situation where Hu Yang is equally equipped and can hold four lightsabers if he wants to against Grievous, who's taken down who?
Huh. I gotta say, you make a really good case, because I was about to say Grievous all day and like, what are you smoking over there? But you make a really good case. They're both droids. They both have multiple limbs. They're both competent in sword fighting, more than competent. And the fact that Hu Yang has like 1,000 years of experience watching Jedi, learning every lightsaber technique. Damn, that's really interesting, Lou. That's a hard one to answer. I think I'd probably still, you know, if I had to bet my life on it, like, I'd probably go Grievous, because Grievous's will to live is just like, and will to survive. We've seen him get away from he gets away from every close call imaginable until he doesn't in the, so I think his will, he's like, he just has this like, he's so angry. He's so bitter. I think that would drive him to survive. But yeah, Hu Yang would absolutely put up a good fight. And, yeah, you convinced me that it's a pretty fair fight. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I do think Grievous is taking it at the end of the day. I do. For all the reasons you said, he is, I think his form is custom built for, you know, killing and dueling. And he's had so much he's killed so many Jedi and he's had that experience. And those were Jedi. And to counter my own argument, Hu Yang has the benefit of Grievous not being a Jedi, but Grievous has taken down multiple Jedi who are Jedi and can read his movements and can anticipate. So that's not a problem for him. I do think he takes the fight, but I don't think it's instantaneous. I don't think it's as quick as Obi-Wan taking down Maul or Ahsoka taking down Merrick.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great question, though. You changed my mind on that one. Yeah.
And Merrick, actually, just to close the chapter on this character, were you disappointed? I was kind of disappointed that Merrick was very cool, very promising. The fact that he's in a mask and has this mysterious voice, like when I was watching the show for the first time, from episode to episode, I kept speculating on like, oh, are they going to take off his mask? Is it going to be somebody? Is it going to be Ezra? Who is this character? And ultimately, it just doesn't really go anywhere. I think like what they're implying visually when he gets sliced open and all the green mist comes out of him is that he's one of those zombies like we saw in the Night Sisters episodes of Clone Wars and Rebels maybe, where they just animate corpses with the green magic, which in itself is interesting that this guy who is probably a former Inquisitor, I don't know, I feel like I'm doing more work to bridge the gap between like the origin of this character than the show really did. And I was ultimately left disappointed with him. Yeah, what about you?
Yeah, I agree. You made the perfect analogy last episode that he is like the new Captain Phasma. Huge potential, interesting look, villainous, dastardly, and then gone. Just a lot of untapped potential there.
Yeah. All right. So that wraps up our discussion on Ahsoka parts 3 and 4. And so, listeners, thank you for staying with us this long. Like we teased at the beginning, we have, and I want to explain this again in case you're just tuning in or you missed it last time. But Evan and I were given screeners by Dave Filoni and Star Wars, Disney, I guess, of this upcoming show. Sheev and Somehow, and it's about two brothers just trying to make it together in this crazy pre-war world, and they're sharing an apartment. And so in the last episode we covered episode 1 of this new show. Did you watch episode 2? Could we talk about episode 2 a little bit?
I'm ready to dive in.
All right. So what I loved this episode, the title of it was Somehow Palpatine Returned. Again, without the comma, because the whole premise of this show is it's explaining that line from episode 9, Rise of Skywalker, where Poe Dameron says, somehow Palpatine returned. And, you know, the internet had a field day with it. They were like, well, that's ridiculous. They don't really bother explaining anything about it. But again, what we've discovered from watching these episodes of Sheev and Somehow is that it's not somehow, comma, Palpatine returned. It's somehow Sheev Palpatine's brother, somehow. So I like that this episode was just called that, Somehow Palpatine Returned, and it's all about how, surprisingly, Sheev and Somehow share a bunk bed, and Somehow went to Bed Bath & Beyond, or whatever the equivalent is on Coruscant, and he got the wrong size sheets, and so he had to take them back to the store. So Somehow Palpatine returned those sheets, and Sheev was mad because he didn't get a full refund for them because they were already out of the package. And it just led to a big conflict between the brothers. I was impressed with Sheev's restraint that he didn't resort to force lightning this time or force choking his brother. Overall, what was your take? Do you feel like this episode did a good job advancing the relationship and the tension between the brothers?
Yeah, like you, I'm also glad that Sheev didn't resort to force lightning. I mean, you can only do that so many times to get out of a sticky situation. I did like how this episode kind of had like a bit of a Seinfeld vibe to it, kind of a show about nothing. Like it was just about sheets and about returning them and kind of a slice of life kind of thing. And I also like that the person at the return counter at the Bed Bath & Beyond, they're kind of setting up like a will they, won't they between somehow and this and the counter. I think her name was Jam Weasley. And so I'm hopeful that throughout the series we're going to get a little like flirtation, like is somehow going to, you know, maybe ask her out on a date, because her manager, I think, is also her boyfriend. So there's like all this like love triangle thing. But I think that's setting it up for future episodes.
Yeah, I could have done with less Jar Jar Binks as the kooky neighbor. You know, it's that we got enough of that character in the prequel movies, and it doesn't even bother explaining like why during this period he's out of the Gungan homeworld, because it's before he got kicked out of there, right? But maybe that's what they're setting up. Maybe they're leading into, you know, they found out that the Gungan's boss Nass found out Jar Jar was living a second life and had this secret apartment right next door to the Chancellor. And or the future chancellor, I should say, is at the time he was still just what, a senator?
Yeah, he's still a senator, right? Because we see him commuting to the Senate office building. The Jar Jar was an odd choice by the producers. The casting choice too, Stanley Tucci. That doesn't really add up for me.
I disagree. Tucci knocked it out of the park, in my opinion. I wish they got Ahmed Best for The Mandalorian. I don't know why they couldn't get him back for this show. That was kind of weird, but I do think Stanley Tucci's a great backup.
Okay. Swinger. I guess I could go for that. But don't you think it was weird how he wasn't wearing any makeup? It just looked like Stanley Tucci.
Yes.
With a name tag that just said Jar Jar Binks.
I do, but I also think that speaks to why we don't see Sheev busting out the Force Lightning all the time. The special effects budget, you know, they're kind of trying to keep it down a little bit. And also, I feel like the screeners we got, it's all pre-rendered. So I think we saw the Tucci in full, just Stanley Tucci. But I think once the show is actually released on Disney Plus, we're going to get the full overlay.
All right, well, I'll take your word for it, because I can't look at any more cardboard sets. I mean, it's just...
Fair enough. All right, so I think that's going to wrap up this episode of Loth Chat with Lou and Heaven. We talked about the first, so we covered the first half of Ahsoka. Stay tuned. Next episode, we're going to cover episodes 5 and 6. And... I guess that's all I got for this. May the Force be with you.
And with you.
Tong's days, am I right?
Lerman!
Well, it's standard Jedi protocol that blah, 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 blah.
Protocol droid for the win.
He's like C-3PO if he wasn't a coward.
Darth Billie Eilish and her robots with capes.
You're supposed to be my brother-in-law, Anakin.
We were gonna go to family business together, Anakin.
I would have seen you at the reunion, Anakin.
The show the New York Times calls The Odd Couple, but bad.
Are you just asking for hate mail right now?
You can go to the space prom.